Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Slack. Before there was podcast, there was radio. Before that, the stage. And before that, you get the idea. Things evolve, technology changes, and we do too. So now we can listen to a show wherever, whenever, however. Why should our work be any different? Why can't we work with more freedom, more flexibility, more choices? That's how Slack works. It's a digital headquarters that works how you work. And Slack is where the future works.
What grows in the forest? Our imagination and our family bonds. The forest is closer than you think. Find a forest near you at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
I'm John Gonzalez, the host of SI's new podcast, Sports Illustrated Weekly. Sports Illustrated has delivered some of the best storytelling in sports for 70 years. And now that continues on our show. Each week, we'll dive deep into the best stories from around the sports world. Sports Illustrated Weekly is available every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe now.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and you might know us from our other podcast, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. But today, you have apparently wandered into our Hall of Cursed Inventions. No, wait, it's not all cursed inventions.
Not
on
all
this
cursed,
show.
You know. I mean, some things are perfectly fine inventions. Some of them make our lives better. But, you know.
Or they taunt you with goods that you could almost reach. Robert, when you were a kid, did you ever play that game? I suppose it was a game, but I took it very seriously, where you really thought you could reach up through the bottom of the vending machine and get that food item from the bottom row.
I do not remember trying too hard at it because it ultimately seemed like there were too many risks, both physical and social. Mm-hmm. Because either you are going to get your arm caught in there or jammed or pinched. There's going to be some sort of trap or fail safe, or you're just going to be seen doing it and you're going to get in trouble for trying to steal from a candy machine.
It always seemed like a kind of humiliating Homer Simpson-esque way to die would be you die accidentally pulling the vending machine over on top of you while you're trying to reach up and grab some Andy Cap hot fries from the bottom row.
Exactly. And, you know, these are two key points, though, that we're gonna come back to again and again in this episode. In this episode, we are talking about the vending machine.
AKA the robot cashier.
That's right. So time was, back in the olden days.
Ye olden days.
When you had to either buy goods directly from a human salesperson.
That sounds horrible.
or you simply had to leave payment after you took off with it. And as far as that payment goes, prior to the invention of money, which will have to be another episode for us, you'd have to leave goods there and you know, an exchange, some sort of a barter system.
Well, that sounds difficult if you can't work out what the exchange rate for what you're bringing is.
So, right, in either case, though, there's a human interaction or there's some human judgment on what is fair, or there's just some sort of an honor system in place.
Right. Or a human there just to prevent you from stealing.
Right. But then what about a machine that sells goods for you? Something that has become so ubiquitous now, it's fascinating to think back on where the shift occurs. We get into this vending machine territory. Just where does such a machine come from? At what point do we cross over from machines that are ultimately little more than honor boxes, you know, honor system situations where you're just trusted to leave your money and take exactly what you paid for? And then where do we get into true mechanical sellers?
Right. The honor box system is what you would often find in, say, a church where they'll be selling prayer candles or something like that. And there's a little offering box and it's like, you know, please put a dollar in and don't just take all the candles.
Right. And yeah, the honor system is enforced by the sacred nature of the space and your obligations there.
There's a supernatural security guard in that case.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to worry about, you know, somebody trying to reach their hand in there, just make off with all the candles for the most part.
But you really do have to worry about that if, say, you want to sell minor food items, snack items, and say you're running a concession stand at the poolside or something like
right.
that, and you need to run off to put some money in the parking meter or, I don't know, whatever the people manning those concession stands had to do when they put up the sign that said, be right back.
Yeah.
So kids are coming. They want to buy an ice cream bar or a Snickers or something like that, and the goods are just right there. Do you trust the children to leave money on the counter as they should and take things and take only what they've actually paid for? Wouldn't it be better if you had a machine that enforced the exchange of currency for payout of items and didn't allow kids to sneak an extra hot fries here and there?
Now, of course, as we're talking about honor boxes here, one of the important things to note is that you'll still find plenty of honor boxes out on the street in the form of newspaper honor boxes.
Oh, the newspaper vending machines.
Yeah, you put your money in, and if you wanted, yes, you could take all the newspapers.
That would be cumbersome.
Yes.
How often does somebody want more than one newspaper, though, unless
right.
they're like there's an article about them in it?
Right. But obviously you could not do the same with, say, a cola machine or a chocolate machine.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder something that we can maybe come back to in a bit, because I wonder how the psychology of transaction and the psychology of consumer behavior changes when you're dealing with a machine versus with a person. Because I think back to my childhood self who, you know, I would reach my arm up in the machine and see if I could grab a brisk tea out of the drink machine or grab something out of the snack machine. I don't think I was ever able to do anything like that. But I would try, and I would never do that at even if the concession stand attendant was away and I could have just reached out and stolen whatever I wanted. I would never have done that at a real concession stand that was not controlled by machine-operated mechanisms.
Yeah, it's a different scenario entirely. And then at the same time, it's ultimately not. It's still somebody's property that is for sale.
Uh-huh.
There are still individuals involved in the scenario, and you are defrauding them.
Well, it felt completely legitimate to try to reach into the machine and steal from it in a way that it wouldn't from a place that had a human, even if they weren't there right now.
Right, because you would have been exploiting a design flaw, right?
Yeah. I guess so. Maybe that makes it okay.
It doesn't. To be clear. But let's go back in time a bit. Let's look for the roots of the vending machine. So I was reading through an excellent book on the social history of the vending machine titled Vending Machines, An American Social History by Carrie Seagrave. And it points out that the first American vending machines popped up in the 1880s. But the earliest mention of what we can reasonably describe as a vending machine is attributed to the Greek inventor Hero or Heron, the Alexandrian engineer of the first century CE.
Okay, now Hero has tons of inventions attributed to him.
Right, and the book that this stems from is loaded with descriptions of strange devices. So the 62 CE book Pneumatica has descriptions and illustrations of various curios, fountains, temple gadgets, doors that open due to the, some sort of movement of steam or fire or water, with entries like a drinking horn in which a peculiarly formed siphon is fixed, and water driven from the mouth of a wineskin in the hands of a satyr by means of compressed air. So a lot of curios and marvels, toys, essentially.
So it sounds like he designed one of those early on, like peeing fountains, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, which would have been technological wonders then, and are still kind of technological wonders today.
But where does the vending machine come in?
Well, he describes and illustrates a coin-operated device for selling sacred water in Egyptian temples.
Okay, so the idea is maybe you don't believe in the honor box system, like we discussed for buying candles in a church or something. Maybe you think, well, people are just going to be stealing sacred water if we don't make them pay for it. So you need a machine to enforce that transaction.
Well, I don't know how much of it was, because I think there is still an honor system. I mean, it's a temple, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there's a sense of, let's make it a little wondrous, because a number of these devices kind of like that. Like the doors open, as if by sacred magic, but of course it's supposedly caused by, some sort of heat apparatus. But here's how this device would work.
Okay.
You'd insert a 5-drachma coin, and the coin would tip a balance inside, which would lift a plug and allow a small amount of water to escape and then pour into your chalice or cup or what have you. And then once the coin makes its way into the collection chamber, the balance returns and the plug goes back into place.
Okay, so it sounds like a very simple design. You've got like a lever, and when the weight of the coin hits one side of the lever, like a seesaw, it lifts the plug up, and it's kind of like a toilet, actually.
It is very much like a modern toilet, especially when you see the illustration. It basically functions like a coin-operated flush.
Nice.
I should also point out that Saeed Chakran also discusses this in his American Scientist article, Water Fountains with Special Effects, from 2005. But it still certainly benefited from an honor system of sorts. So, the gods are watching, so you're not going to try and cheat the machine with some sort of a coin on a string or some smooth stones that are just happen to be shaped like a 5-drachma coin.
Right, because this was not a refined system of judging what had been put into the slot. It was basically anything that could push the lever down.
Right. Now, in terms of like who actually invented this and whether it was actually built, this is a little more difficult to really figure out. It's certainly possible that Hero himself was indeed the inventor of the device, but we don't know for sure. It might have been Ctesibius, a reputed inventor of water clocks from 270 BCE, who also would have resided in Alexandria.
Ctesibius's water clocks are worth looking up, by the way. I was looking at some videos of how these things worked, and there was some ingenious design, because it's difficult to design a consistent water clock that just keeps working the same over time, because your reservoir tanks drain down. So he created these really smart designs with like extra reservoir tanks that would pour into your main reservoir tank, and then a siphon to manage mm-hmm. how high the water level was. It was really clever.
Now, we also don't know if what Hero describes here was ever actually built or if it's just a novel design.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the case with a lot of old technological gadgets that you see described in books. And then on top of this, some mentions of this vending machine include embellishments that are difficult to nail down or simply don't fit the timeline. But it does give us an idea of what some of the earliest, if not an actual vending machine consisted of, then at least the earliest ideas of what a vending machine could be.
Right, the general principle of automating a transaction without just relying on the honor system on the buyer's part.
Right, and it's kind of a gradual evolution to get to that point. However, as Seagrave points out, it's going to be a long time after.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
After this this temple device described by a hero, before we actually get any real advancements in vending machine technology, he does point out there's some, for instance, there's an uncredited 1960 New York Times article that claims, among other things, that there was a coin-operated pencil-selling machine in 1076 China.
You know, I was really holding out for that medieval European vending machine that you put in a coin and dispenses a piece of the true cross.
Well, I mean, there were certainly automatons throughout European history. I guess with the vending machine, especially the early days of the vending machine, you're looking for a very particular type of automaton that does something. Or rather, not just does something, but actually gives some sort of good in exchange, either, you know, leaks out some sort of valuable liquid or gives you a candy bar in exchange for a coin. Because you have all manner of amazing automatons showing up in European history, and everything from pooping ducks to praying monks. Mm-hmm. But to what extent do you have things that are actually facilitating an exchange of money for goods?
All right, we'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we will discuss more of the history of the vending machine.
Today's episode is brought to you by Slack. Before there was podcast, there was radio. Before that, the stage. And before that, you get the idea. Things evolve, technology changes, and we do too. So now we can listen to a show wherever, whenever, however. Why should our work be any different? Why can't we work with more freedom, more flexibility, more choices? That's how Slack works. It's a digital headquarters that works how you work. And Slack is where the future works.
Give us your attention. We need everything you got fast. Waiting on reparations. We be the illest podcast.
Tune in every Thursday. Politics and wordplay. We fight for the people because they got us in the worst way.
From the hill to Brazil, Bombay to Kanye.
From the left enclave to what the neocons say.
Every Thursday, cop the heady conversation.
And break us off with some bread because we're waiting on reparations.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Adoption of teens from foster care is a topic not enough people know about, and we're here to change that. I'm April Dinwiddie, host of the new podcast, Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Each episode brings you compelling real-life adoption stories told by the families that live them with commentary from experts. Visit adoptuskids.org/podcast or subscribe to Navigating Adoption, presented by Adopt US Kids. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families and the Ad Council.
All right, we're back. So according to Seagrave, quote, nothing happened in the vending industry until the 17th century. and that's when you had snuff and tobacco boxes pop up in England around 1615. And these were definitely honor system devices, not unlike newspaper boxes. And they were just filled with various tobacco products instead.
So it'd be kind of like you pay for access to them, but you could take as much as you wanted.
Right. Yeah. Like you pay your money, you fill your pipe, and you move on. You don't fill your pockets. You just fill your pipe. And then you had you had other instances of early advancements in the use of vending machine technology. A couple of centuries later, 1822, English bookseller Richard Carlyle tried a vending machine for books in order to avoid arrest for selling certain blasphemous publications. And
wait a minute. Okay, so he's saying, like, I didn't sell it.
Yeah, a machine sold it.
Nice.
However, he was still held responsible, and one of his employees was convicted for selling blasphemous literature via the machine. Now, it's unknown if the thing was truly automatic or if this was basically another honor box system, but it is kind of one of these early examples of who is to blame when a machine sells something that is illicit.
This is something that has fascinated me for a while. Now, I can think of examples, not necessarily with selling, but I think about the experiment from several years back, the random darknet shopper, which was this program that people came up with where you could load it with some budget, give it some money, and then say, go, little thing, just go out onto the dark web and buy randomly.
Oh, God.
So, you know, then they got in trouble because obviously it bought drugs.
Oh.
Bought whatever kinds of illicit materials, but then they could say, well, we didn't tell it to buy drugs. We just gave it money and released it into the wild. So how can you say we did something illegal?
Now, more strides were made in the tobacco honor box arena, but the next area of exploration and patent in England happened to be stamps.
Hmm.
1857, Simeon Denham applied for a patent for a, quote, self-acting machine for the delivery of postage and receipt stamps. But it would be another 30 years before any real headway was made in this area. Now, the first U.S. patent for a vending machine was a liquid distribution machine that actually sounds a lot like Hero's fabulous temple water distributor.
What kind of liquid, though?
Well, it's interesting when we start looking at the early distribution of liquids in these machines. Like, they're essentially fountains that are going to distribute drinking water, such as cold drinking water,
mm-hmm.
or later it's going to be things like beer.
That makes sense.
Now, by the early 20th century, gum and candy machines began taking off. Now, one of the machines featured in Seagrave's book is an amazingly creepy clown head.
This thing is from hell. It is this very round, oh my God, its face. It looks kind of like an oni,
yes.
The Japanese oni, that kind of demon, but much worse, much more kind of, it's got these creepy, sleepy eyes that are like, when I wake up, I will come kill you.
Well, it doesn't help that the coin slot is kind of protruding from one side of the forehead as if it's a devil with only one horn.
Right, yes.
Yeah,
an asymmetric devil, and it's got this white ring around its mouth is just an absolute terror.
Yeah, and then you pull the gum from its teeth, of course.
like, I was chewing that.
Yeah.
I'll come to your house tonight.
Now, already at this point, there were designer concerns with the use of slugs and hairpins to cheat the machines.
So the idea of a slug is what we mentioned earlier. It's like a weighted device that you'd put on a string or something and put it into the machine and activate the coin detection without actually paying.
Yeah. I mean, you get into this whole thing, like it's not like the machine is reading the coin. It's reading a coin-shaped piece of metal. So if you have a coin-shaped piece of metal that has no intrinsic value, then whammo, you got yourself a piece of gum, right?
Right.
you know, because it comes down to basically whatever kind of honor system works, you know, with a proper English pipe tobacco box or the or, you know, the holy water for sale in the temple, a clown head that spits gum at the local train station is not going to benefit from the same holy reverence, you know?
Though I do wonder if they're onto something here with the clown head, because this is personified.
Yeah, it's looking right at you.
It's anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. And I think that could play an important role in the relationship between the buyer and the vendor. When the vendor is just like a rectangular machine that you need to put a coin in, would you be more or less likely to try to defraud that machine than you would a machine that looks like a creepy demonic entity that could follow you home?
It's true. You know, another twist on this, though, is that you also saw charitable vending machines pop up in late 19th century France, which this seems like a decent way to invoke the honor system for machines that can't really defend themselves, you know? It's like, yes, you're buying gum or what have you from a crappy machine that you could probably defraud, but the money's going to charity, so how much of a monster are you really?
You might be surprised.
Now, speaking of defrauding machines, the earliest record of a vandalized machine, according to Seagrave, comes from 1887 in England. Three young men were convicted for using brass discs to buy cigarettes. And then there's also an 1891 St. Louis account where a man had a coin on a string and he was using it to score cigars out of a machine.
Okay.
And it was creating quite a stir. People were coming around to watch him do it like he was performing some sort of magic trick. And the judge in this case, he wasn't even sure if this was larceny and ended up just fining the man for disorderly conduct instead. Again, coming back to that same conundrum, how do I punish a man for stealing from an inhuman entity?
Yeah, is stealing from a machine really stealing?
Now, another concern, of course, with all this is that today we have problems with vending machines not working properly, you know?
Right.
You go to, you put in your money, you expect to get a candy bar, and it like sticks to the side, right? So obviously you had similar issues back in the day with these clumsier machines.
I'd imagine even more often, right? Like you try to get the gum out of the clown's mouth, but instead it just kind of makes a grinding noise.
Yes. And I think one of the more, I mean, when you look at the history of vending machines, on one hand, you see like the definite areas where people realize, yes, we're going to use these to sell candy. We're going to sell cigarettes. These are the obvious uses. But what I really loved about researching this was seeing the various areas where they were just throwing it at everything to see what would stick.
Right.
There was a real flash in the pan sense to many of these applications. Some of the stuff generated attention but then didn't find a place in society. And yet, you still see early versions of vending devices that we now take for granted, like gasoline pumps, water pumps. Well, maybe not beer spigots, but you also had these beer spigots that you put money into, and then you fill up your glass.
I don't know. There's some pretty strange vending machines out there today, and it's still a developing field.
Yeah.
Like I'm sure you've read about like live animal vending machines, like there are live lobster vending machines live crab vending machines.
I did enjoy when I was in China several years back, I got to see a wine vending machine where you put your money in. It was very high tech too. You know, it had the computer interface, but ultimately you would get an entire bottle of wine out of it.
Oh, a bottle. It wasn't like a spigot of
wine. No, not a spigot. Like it was distributing full bottles of wine.
Uh-huh.
Now, the 1890s also saw the birth of the slot machine. Now, not the gambling engine that would evolve from it and keep its name, but basic coin-operated machines that sold various odds and ends. So cigarettes, stationery, etc.
So early on, there was a link between vending machines and gambling machines. And sometimes the blurring of that line would help you get around gambling restrictions.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of a whole episode, maybe it was more than one episode that we did for Stuff to Blow Your Mind about the slot machine, about gambling and gambling psychology and gambling devices.
Yeah.
And
automated gambling.
Yeah. And there's a clear history here. That's part of the legacy of vending machines is the gambling machine. You would not have the gambling machine without these early vending machines.
You know, we often see new technologies take on a kind of chic appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And I do wonder sometimes if you would have seen that in early vending machines. Like when a vending machine became the new way you could buy an item in a place, like would people come to think that an item bought from a vending machine as opposed to bought from a human selling point would be cooler, would be better?
Yeah, I mean, it's the basic novelty attraction, right? Like, here's this new technology, this new way of doing this thing I was going to do anyway. I think one of the best examples of this is the rise and ultimately the fall of automats.
Oh, yeah.
So
I always think about that scene in Dark City with the automat.
Yes, there's a wonderful scene with an automat in Dark City. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what we're talking about and or you haven't seen Dark City, we're talking about a restaurant in which the walls are lined with all of these little doors with little windows. And behind each window, you see a plate or a dish, you know, some sort of food that's prepared. And you put your coin in and then you open that little...
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Door, and then you take the plate.
So it's like apple, green jello,
yes,
sandwich.
And these were real. This was something from Dark City that you can take to the bank. The first of these opened in Berlin in 1895. And yeah, it was true novelty, because you'd be hard-pressed to find a true automat today. But the basic concept lives on in probably one of my favorite restaurant innovations, the conveyor belt sushi restaurant. Have you been to one of these, Joe?
No, I haven't. I've heard you talk about it.
Oh, it's marvelous. I highly recommend everyone go to one. Afterwards, you will feel cheated if a human brings you your food at a restaurant as opposed to a conveyor belt that has tiny little plates with like bubble canopies over them.
So at the... On the conveyor belt, how do they keep track of what food you have taken?
Oh, well, they have a fabulous system, at least the place that I frequent, because my child loves it, and I love it too, is that after you're done, you have to stick the plate into a receptacle, and it counts the plates.
Ah.
So you're charged by the plate, and you're also encouraged – there's gamification here as well. You're encouraged to insert more plates, because if you hit – I want to say it's like 15 plates – you get a little prize.
Nice.
That comes out like a vending machine. So it's this wonderful collision of these different vending machine concepts into one food delivery system. Now, it's also worth pointing out that even though the automat went away, in many ways it lives on in just modern cafeterias.
Oh, yeah.
And ultimately, I guess it comes down to the fact that you really didn't have to have the food behind all those little locked doors.
You had to have it in a wrapper.
You just needed to have it in some steamer trays, put up some sneeze guards, and have, what, one, two humans around just to make sure you didn't do anything stupid.
You can never really make sure, though, Robert.
You never can.
I've worked in a grocery store. I know what people do with food items.
I guess it comes down to what do the vast majority of the customers do with the food items, right?
The vast majority of people are very nice and very well behaved.
Yeah, it's not everybody that's sticking their arm up the cola machine or or trying to cheat it with little discs of lead or something.
We're poking popsicle sticks down in there. That's when I tried. I know. What was wrong with me? Why was I so into defrauding machines?
You just wanted to – it was just your rage against the machine, Joe. That's clearly what was going on.
I was kind of a little Boy Scout in other ways. Like I never would have done that to
– You were a natural butlerian is what you were.
I guess.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about just the legacy of vending machine technology.
I'm John Gonzalez, the host of Sports Illustrated Weekly. Sports Illustrated has delivered the best storytelling in sports for 70 years. First in the pages of the magazine, then on SI.com, and now that tradition continues on a new podcast. Each week, we'll dive deep into the best stories from around the sports world. We'll ask the questions that we're all wondering and push for the answers we all want. Everything from investigating the Super Bowl's impact on LA to examining why booing is as big a part of the fan experience as cheering. Sports Illustrated Weekly is here to bring you the entertaining tales you can't get anywhere else. The kinds of stories that make you smile and laugh, clap and cry, marvel, think, and fall in love with sports all over again. Sports Illustrated Weekly is available every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe now.
Hi, I'm Hillary Clinton, and I'm excited to be back with a new season of You and Me Both. You know, when we started this podcast, we were going through some tough times, and let's face it, we still are. But I am a firm believer we're stronger together. So please join me for more conversations with people who will make you think, make you laugh, and help us find a path forward. Listen to You and Me Both on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Robert Sex Reese, host of the Dr. Sex Reese Show. And every episode, I listen to people talk about their sex and intimacy issues, and yes, I despise every minute of it. I mean, she made mistakes too. Right?
That's true. She kill everyone at her wedding.
But hell is real. We're all trapped here, and there's nothing any of us can do about it. So join me, won't you?
Listen to the Dr. Sex Reese Show every Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
So, of course, vending machines still exist, right? You know, they're all over the place, and they're now fully adapted to the modern economy, many accepting credit cards and so forth, and a lot of them have less cute mechanical tricks behind them. Now they're just sort of electronic and, you know, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I like it when there's an arm, when there is some sort of robotic component. Like there's you can still find ice cream machines that do this where a little lid and a cooler will open behind glass and an arm will go down and grab one of the ice cream pops and bring it out. And I love that because there's a sense of drama to it.
Yes.
Will the claw be able to do it?
Uh-huh.
Or will I have to call this 800 number on the side of the machine and inevitably talk to another automaton?
Well, that is one that is one appeal of the machine, right? That there is an inherent delight in watching how some machines work. Most vending machines aren't really like this. They're mm-hmm. not all that exciting.
But these other ones, the things with arms, like these are coming back to the automatons of Heroes Day and the medieval wonder devices, the philosophical toys they were sometimes called.
They put on a show.
Yeah, they put on a show and they made you think about what was happening. And it wasn't just a matter of, yeah, I want an ice cream and I'll pay a dollar for it.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of legacy, I do want to think about how the vending machine, even the early rudimentary vending machines, did kind of portend something even more significant, something about the automation of the service economy in general. Because you can, of course, point to plenty of vending machines that still exist. You can see them in airports all the time selling headphones and stuff like that. But in a way, you can also look at, for example, online commerce as an extension of the principle of the vending machine across time and space. It's shopping without the interaction with a human vendor. You make your selection from an automated display. You pay an automated cashier and then you receive your item without having to meet anybody.
Yeah. What is, say, Amazon.com, but the biggest vending machine of all time, right?
Yeah.
You can buy everything from it.
But even at in-person purchasing, there has been a push, at least in many cases, to try to automate aspects of the service relationship, right?
Yeah, think of grocery stores, gas pumps. I mean, basically the sort of world that was predicted in early vending machine ventures is what we're living in today. We just managed to keep a few human interactions around, you know, for flavor and or to enforce the honor system.
And to provide flexibility that machines don't have. The human can be there for when something goes wrong or when someone has an unusual need or request.
Yeah, and to service the machines,
yeah,
of course. However, I have to say I'm a little amazed that one particular vending machine design didn't take off. This one is also mentioned in Seagrave's book, comes from 1934, and it's a back of the movie theater seat candy machine.
That is pretty brilliant.
Yeah, like but, every seat in the theater, and then you have a candy machine right on the back of your seat. Just imagine how perfect and perfectly annoying that would be.
I mean, I would hate that because I never buy candy at the movies.
Oh, I would despise it. And for that very reason, I'm surprised that it's not happening right now.
I suspect that maybe the reason that didn't take off is that you want to get people out of the theater into the lobby so that they buy more.
Oh, there's only so much you can sell through a back-of-the-seat vending machine.
Right. You could, by increasing the convenience of selling one popular item, actually decrease overall sales if you just, like, make it too easy to get that one popular thing without people having to be tempted by all these other less popular things.
But on the other hand, some people are not going to want – I don't want to get up in the middle of the movie to go stand in line or even not stand in line to buy food.
But they're always telling you to.
Yeah,
let's
but
all
what
go
if,
to the
what
lobby.
If, I know, but what if I could just buy, you know, a glass of wine and some Twizzlers right there in my seat without involving any human interaction, which I clearly did not come to the movie theater for?
What if you could just swipe your credit card and the ceiling would rain popcorn on you?
Well, that would work too. Hot buttered, of course.
You know, Robert, picking up from this, I wonder – in fact, I was about to ask you, but I don't have to ask you because I've been to one with you. These new school restaurants that have you order through an automated touchscreen menu rather than talking to your server.
Oh, yes. We encountered this at an airport, as I recall.
LaGuardia.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were at a restaurant – every restaurant I've been to at LaGuardia in New York works like this. And what I wondered at that restaurant was, do consumers behave in a measurably different way when they're ordering or buying through a machine than when they're ordering or buying through a person? And the data says in many cases, absolutely yes. Hmm. People do behave different when they shop through machines versus when they shop through human gatekeepers. I wanted to call attention to a 2015 interview piece I read by Gretchen Gavitt in the Harvard Business Review with Harvard Business Professor Ryan Buell, who talks about this change in human behavior with automated selling versus human selling. And so one very common trend is in food sales. Think about like the restaurant that's got the automated ordering pad or online ordering apps. What research has found is that people who order food through machines rather than people tend to order more food and more customized food.
Oh.
So, for example—
because there's no social barrier
right.
to being a pain in the butt.
Exactly. I think that's exactly it. So Taco Bell, they had a digital app you could order through. So mm-hmm. you didn't have to talk to a person. You just order in the app and then pick it up. And what they found was that orders were 20% more expensive when ordered through the app than when people had to talk to somebody to order, mostly because people picked more add-on ingredients in the app. So it's like, yeah, I want to add sour cream. I want to add whatever. Also, Chili's apparently reported that more people started ordering desserts when they could order through self-service computers that were stationed at their tables. And movie theaters have reported that self-service kiosks mean people keep ordering more and more stuff.
Well, I think another aspect of this might be situations where you are relying on memory while you're ordering in a kind of, at times, at least for people like me, a high-pressure social situation. You're at the front, yes, of the poke bowl line. You're trying to order your poke bowl, and you're having to – and people are looking at you. People are waiting on you, and you have to also remember all the things you just said and are saying, and also keeping in mind what you're about to order for your child or somebody else who's, fetching drinks or what have you. Like, there are a lot of moving pieces, and if you can – externalize that process or part of that process onto a screen, then it is a calmer situation for all involved. That's why we check things off on a sushi menu, mm-hmm, as opposed to telling the server.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's less pressure, there's less of a rush, but I think it's also very important that there's less self-consciousness, mm-hmm, because I want to talk about a couple of other studies. One was a 2014 study that looked at liquor stores, and they found if a liquor store switches over to self-service, the market share of, quote, difficult to pronounce items increases more than 8%. Oh. So people buy more hard to pronounce liquor products if they don't have to interact with a human when they buy them.
Oh, so I won't be self-conscious about trying to order chartreuse?
Chartreuse?
Chartreuse? Chartreuse?
Chartreuse? Chartreuse? I think it's chartreuse.
Sounds good to me, but I would be a little hesitant. I would say that bottle, that uh-huh, one, the one with the horse on it.
Robert, have you ever done the online pizza app ordering?
No, I haven't, but I have.
It's a thing they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I know Domino's does that. I think they all do, all the big chains, or maybe not all of them. Most of the big chains do that now. And pizza chains that introduce automated online ordering find that people order higher calorie meals when they order through the app, and they also order with way more special instructions. So if you're somebody who's like, I want the gluten-free dough, but not as a crust. I want it chopped up and sprinkled as a topping. That people are more likely to do that on the app than they are talking to somebody on the phone.
Because, yeah, you don't feel like you're inconveniencing anyone,
right,
with your, ridiculously detailed order.
Exactly. So it seems like a recurring feature is that people just might feel less self-conscious when they order through a machine than when they order through a human. And the machine isn't going to judge what you eat or how unhealthy what you're ordering is or how complicated your special instructions are or how you pronounce things. The machine doesn't judge. There's no fear. It just takes the order mechanically. Now, of course, this isn't without downsides. In this article, Buell points out that a lot of companies also lose business from attempting to institute self-service kiosks and stuff like that because it might make customers feel like they're getting less value from the business, they're having to do too much work, or they don't have the flexibility they would when interacting with a human agent. A lot of it probably has to do with how easy these things are to interact with. But I wonder how much that whole thing can be extrapolated not just to – I mean, most of this is focused on food, mm-hmm, but it can be extrapolated to commerce as a whole. When you go to a vending machine, when you order something online, when you order through a little iPad or something at your table, instead of talking to a human or having to look a human in the eye when you do any of this buying, purchasing behavior, how does that change how you spend your money and what choices you make with your life?
And indeed, these are changes that certainly to many of the individuals, we're not even fully aware of what's happening. Meanwhile, the companies that are rolling this out are often going to be hyper aware of what's happening. They're going to, it's like McDonald's. They know you're going to spend a dollar more, and therefore they're going to do the math and figure out that this is the way of the future, that you need to be ordering through the machine so you'll spend more.
I absolutely understand this working like at the level. I have personally experienced feeling the freedom to order things I would be embarrassed to order out loud with, mm-hmm, my voice if I ordered them on an app, like ordering some kind of complicated request or request for extra stuff.
And yet at the same time, like one thing that comes to mind is really the domain of films. Mm-hmm. Obviously one can obtain any film you want pretty much, especially good films. You can get through digital means and you can order a copy of it, rent it, et cetera. when you go into the right kind of video store, I guess some people might be embarrassed to ask for certain titles, but there's also a pride in asking for certain titles. Like you want to be recognized for being the person that that wants to watch Leviathan, you know? Like you do want kind of a social connection, and you want approval for participating in this transaction. And you're not going to get that from the machine. You're not going to be judged, but you're also not going to be celebrated.
Well, it just highlights how the social aspects of commerce are a double-edged sword. Sometimes having a person there to react to you socially and engage with you socially is going to be a limiting factor in what you would do and how much you would indulge and all that because you're afraid of judgment. And other times it will be an empowering factor, or I don't know if the word is empowering, if it would be an encouraging factor, encouraging you to participate in this act of commerce because there's some kind of positive social benefit to it.
And if nothing else, I just want there to be a conveyor belt, you know?
Right.
At least there needs to be a sense of wonder. There needs to be some sort of spectacle going on, even if it's just a small one.
You know, one last thing I was thinking about is I've never tried to cheat or defraud Amazon or anything like that. But I wonder, like, if my feeling from childhood is generalizable, that people, for some reason, while they would never try to steal from a human or a physical brick-and-mortar store, would try to reach their arm up into the vending machine. Does the same thing apply to these more modern worldwide vending machines, like online commerce retailers or just normal stores that delegate all of the selling functions to machines and apps and stuff like that?
I wonder to what extent we attribute Amazon with a little more agency than we would give, say, a Coca-Cola machine.
Yeah.
All right. So there you have it. That is the episode of Invention for this week. We do hope that you will check out inventionpod.com. That is where you'll find the existing episodes of the Invention podcast. You'll also find links out to our social media accounts. And if you want to talk about this episode inside of a Facebook group, you should go to the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module, because that is where we are known to hang out and discuss episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, but we're also happy to talk about episodes of Invention.
Huge thanks, as always, to Scott Benjamin for research assistance on this show, and to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
On the latest season of the Next Question with Katie Couric podcast, Katie dives into, well, Katie. Hear exclusive podcast-only conversations between Katie and the people who made her memoir, Going There, possible.
Katie is a pack rat, and she has basically her own archive of sorts in her basements.
Plus, Katie explores some of the big news stories she's covered over the decades and the people behind them, like Anita Hill.
I thought I could just get back to my life. And that wasn't possible. It was not going to be the same.
There's plenty of Katie's signature curiosity and no-holds-barred interviews, along with some of her own revealing answers.
We spent a lot of time together around a dining room table here and in the city, and, you know, it was a very intense experience.
All episodes of Next Question with Katie Couric are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check out the new podcast, I Am Kobe. Do you want to understand how Kobe Bryant achieved his unequaled determination? How did he come to his incredible passion to win? In I Am Kobe, we reveal intimate, never-before-heard tapes of Kobe when he was a teenager, just as he was starting to glimpse his own greatness. It's about the making of an icon. We weave together these tapes with Kobe's high school coaches, his friends, and the figures who knew him in his youth. All episodes are out now, so you can binge the whole thing. Listen to I Am Kobe on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm John Gonzalez, the host of SI's new podcast, Sports Illustrated Weekly. Sports Illustrated has delivered some of the best storytelling in sports for 70 years. And now that continues on our show. Each week, we'll dive deep into the best stories from around the sports world. Sports Illustrated Weekly is available every Wednesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe now.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.